This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
This is Walter Edgar, and today we will present a conversation I had with author Cassandra King, recorded before a live audience in late 2016 at the Newbury Opera House. Well, Sandra, us two Alabama folks are here talking about somebody from South Carolina tonight.
Imagine that.
Yeah, and you know, reading the blogs, which, the, you know, the new book that's just out on Pat, edited by Nan Talese, his editor for many, many years, it took a while for Pat to get into the 20th century in terms of technology, didn't it?
He never really got into it. He certainly went kicking and screaming. He didn't do email until I tried to get him to do email, because he didn't answer his phone. If anyone ever tried to call him, you know that. He didn't answer his phone. He didn't read letters. He didn't, you know, he was impossible to communicate with. So I finally, maybe 10, 12 years ago, got him to do email. And he did like it. He discovered that he could keep up with folks that way. Now, he couldn't type. So when he answered the emails, he would, you know, he wouldn't space or anything, and punctuation, it just all ran together. It was pathetic. But I think those emails are probably treasures for folks now. And then the blogs. Well, first of all, Pat had a Facebook page, and he didn't even know what Facebook was. His publisher did that for him. And it would be real, I'd feel really bad sometimes when I meet someone and say, oh, I sent a message to Mr. Conroy on his Facebook page, and he wrote me back the nicest response. And, of course, I'd be thinking, bless your heart, that wasn't him. But they did talk him into blogging, and that is an ugly word. He said he would probably blog if they'd call it something else. And so he called it his letters to his readers. And he would write those out and send them in, and publisher would type, they would have them typed up and posted on his Facebook.
So when he sent them in to the publisher, though, were they on computer, or did he still write them out by hand?
No, he wrote them out by hand.
Okay,
we'd make copies of them and sent them in, and they would type them up. And
okay, that's what I still find amazing. Now, how did a sweet girl from Alabama run in to Pat Conroy?
It was in Alabama. That's what he got for coming, you know, to my home state.
And where was that?
It was in 1995. He came to a writer's conference to get one of his many awards. And Pat always teased because he had, you know, boo-koodles of awards, but he said that he'd never got an award anyone had ever heard of before. Which, of course, is not typical Pat stuff. But he was getting a Southern Writer Achievement Award or something like that, that this writer's conference gave. This was in Birmingham. So I attended the conference. I was supposed to be a presenter that year. But since my first novel was a small press, they didn't have it ready on time, which was kind of good, because had they had it ready, I wouldn't have gotten a blurb from Pat Conroy. So I met him and at the reception, and we were chatting, and someone came up to us and said, I guess she's telling you about her first book. And I was, oh, hush, don't. Ooh, I was so embarrassed, you know, that I would have the audacity. I mean, a sweet Southern belle would never do such a thing, you know. So, but remember, I failed that course. But even so, I wasn't telling him any such thing. I would have been horrified. And he said to me, why didn't you tell me you had a book coming out? You didn't tell me you were a writer. And I said, oh, it's, you know, it's nothing and all this kind of stuff. Because I was so embarrassed. But anyhow, he offered to give me a blurb for the book, have my publisher send it. Send
it to him. That was the start of a romance?
It wasn't the start of a romance then, yeah. And that took about 2 years later, he came back. He did call me once he read the book, told me he enjoyed the book and this sort of stuff, and he had called my publisher to give the blurb. And Pat was a big talker, as people who know Pat well know. And we would have these long, long conversations over, and I wouldn't hear from him for months. And then all of a sudden, over the next 2 years, I'd answer the phone and it'd be Pat, hey, he called me King, you know, hey, King, how are you doing? This guy's, oh, I'm doing fine. Where are you? What's going on? This guy says. So then he came back to Birmingham when Ann River Siddons was getting the Southern Achievement Award in 1997. And he asked me if I was going to the conference. And I said, no, I hadn't planned on going. He said, why don't you come go with me to the conference? So now that's when we really started seeing each other.
Okay. And then a year later, you were married.
That's right.
In South Carolina.
In South Carolina, in Charleston.
By Judge Alexanders.
Alexanders, who has become a dear, dear friend.
Tell me the story and tell us the story about our buttons and what all that's about.
Okay. Yeah, we're all wearing our buttons tonight that says, tell me a story. After Pat died, there was a lot of talk in Beaufort of what they were going to do as, you know, sort of memorial for him. And name a bridge after him, you know, a highway, maybe put a statue.
Was he going to come back and haunt him if they did that?
He would definitely. Especially the statue thing. I knew that he would say, don't you let them put a statue of me in the park, waterfront park, right downtown Beaufort, because the pigeons would do what the critics always did.
But don't you think he'd have liked a little boy of Brussels kind of statue?
He wouldn't like any kind. And his agent had, 40 years ago, had started a writer center in Minneapolis that has become, I believe, the second largest in the United States. It's called The Loft. And she was saying, her input was, if we could do something like that for Pat, it would be a living memorial, a writing center, like The Loft. And he knew of The Loft and had visited there and spoken there several times. As soon as this idea was brought forth by his agent, then I knew that was perfect. That was just exactly what we should do for Pat, is start a writing center. Now, that is easier said than done, as you might imagine. So we just had some folks. We were talking to just some of us got together, some of us in the family, you know, just different folks talking about, is this something that we'd really like to do? Because if we're going to do it, it's going to take a commitment. And a lot of work.
It's going to be a physical facility in Beaufort?
It will. We were very fortunate. We found a house that we were able to rent out the bottom floor of this house. And one day, the owner may turn the house over to the center. Right now, we are renting it. It is one block off of Main Street. It's a beautiful old structure that was 1880s. You know, double porch, kind of low country house. So thrilled to have that. And we've got an active board. We had some fundraising going on, which, of course, we had to have. We got our nonprofit status. Took us 3 months, but we got the nonprofit status. And we have just recently hired an executive director.
And since Pat died, you've had people that he touched from his San Francisco days, from his Rome days, have just sent checks?
It's been amazing. We haven't really had any large fundraising event at this point. what we've had instead is like a grassroots, this Facebook that he never knew about and hated and so forth. When his death was posted on his Facebook, he got over four million hits worldwide. So that's what we thought we would do to start out. Once we got our nonprofit status, then we could start just sending out appeals. You know, if you want to help us start this center as a living legacy to Pat, we're going to need your help in order to do so. And we would just get, you know, checks for $25, you know, $100, things, just different things like that, but from all over, just all over the country. And it's just been amazing that.
And I think the heartwarming thing is, it's not just the big checks. It's
all been small, just about. We've had a few large, donations, but
people who were touched by Pat Conroy.
Exactly, and some of the most unbelievable, wonderful letters.
Well, I hope that those letters will either be given to the University Pat Conroy Archives, or they'll be there, because if it's going to be a writing center, there might be a sentence or two for a young writer to find out what it was that inspired.
That's one of the main things, Walter. I wanted to make sure that we have. It's getting permission from some of these, especially the young writers that have written in, telling about why they were such big Pat Conroy fans and why they were so devastated by the loss of him and so forth. And I thought it would be really nice to have a display of those for other people to
read. Well, I mean, just think of, you know, in talking with Pat, he talks about when first he was going through his Hemingway phase, and then he went through his Wolf phase,
yes.
Then was it going to be Gatsby? Laughing all the way, but one of the things that keeps coming back in his blogs, which were written in the last few years of his life, and from his earlier writings in our conversation, is the influence of good teachers on Pat Conroy.
Exactly. Yeah. We certainly want the center to do a lot to honor teachers.
One teacher that he talked about all the time was from right here near Newberry.
That's right.
Gene Norris. He had other Newberry connections. A lot of people think, well, Newberry, and he's always talking about Beaufort, but there are a lot of Newberry connections.
A lot of Newberry connections.
Yeah.
We have Dr. Dufford.
Yes.
Bill Dufford, who I believe is here tonight.
Doc, as he called him, worked his ass off one summer. Painting bookcases, mowing lawns, transplanting shrubbery. But he had a tremendous influence on Pat.
He certainly did. And Pat, you know, spent, I think, a lot of his boyhood and then his young adult, as a young adult, looking for father figures. And I know that Bill and Gene both, in their different ways, fit that.
Well, you know, they're among the conversations that Pat and I had, talks about Gene Norris. You know, here is Pat landing at Beaufort High, a Marine brat, doesn't really have any roots, and this professor, teaches, takes him under his wing and introduces him to Thomas Wolfe, and they end up going to Asheville, to the Thomas Wolfe house.
Right. I don't know that Gene Norris could have ever imagined what kind of influence that would have had on Pat. I remember when I was a freshman in college and went to the William Faulkner house, Roanoke, for the first time. And it just makes such an impression on you. And maybe Gene did know. Maybe there was some part of Gene that knew that this was somebody who really had, he certainly must have known that Pat had the spark for writing and the interest, you know, in Thomas Wolfe and so forth. So maybe he
You use that term, spark. My grandmother used to talk about my sister, the friends my sister and I have, and she would say, well, so-and-so has the spark. And then so-and-so doesn't.
Right.
And we weren't exactly sure what that meant, but looking at later on in life, by the time we were 10 and 12, she'd pretty well identified who had the spark and who didn't. She just sensed that person, that young man or that young woman, was going to make something for themselves.
Exactly.
And that's what the center is all about.
I think that's what the center is all about, is encouraging emerging writers, young writers, students who have this interest, who have this hunger and love of literature, reading, you know, maybe wanting to be a writer, maybe not even wanting to be a writer, but appreciating good writing.
You have the physical space. Now, are people going to be there year-round, or is there going to be a writer's conference like Bread Loaf that Middlebury hosts, you know, during the summer? What are the plans there?
Well, the plans are still in the making with our wonderful new executive director. I'm sure we're going to do a lot of things and have a lot of programs, but the plan basically will be that it will be year-round.
Okay.
Yes. There will be a Pat Conroy Literary Conference in the fall, in October. The first one was done by USCB, mm-hmm. and the University of South Carolina Press, because it was already in the works, mm-hmm. before the center started. Now, we had our soft opening during that weekend, where we had our space ready. We had an exhibit from Pat's papers, USC Library. And it really, Walter, it was very encouraging as well, because, you know, you want to think you offer it and people will come. You know, you build it and they will come, that kind of thing. And that's what you want to think, but you don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, there's and so much, especially with the young people and technology and all these days, that you wonder if there's going to be that much of an interest. Well, if what we saw at the Pat Conroy Literary Festival and our soft opening is indication, it's going to be a big success.
Well, I'm sure it is. And, of course, your executive director, my longtime friend and editor at USC Press, Jonathan Haupt, is going to be there.
Exactly. Yeah, it's been amazing what Jonathan has done at USC Press and the Story River imprint, and hopefully, you know, in the future we'll figure out some way to work together with that. But he is joining us as director of our center.
I'd like to kind of walk a little bit through the book that Nan Talese did, not give everything away, but Pat really bared his soul. I mean, the first blog is he's talking about he almost died on such and such a date. And I think, you know, he had discussed this every now and then in a conversation or a public lecture, but not. But I think this is a side of Pat Conroy that folks might like to hear about his discovering and dealing with it, thanks to you, really.
Oh, well, I'll take full credit.
Well,
no, I'm too.
I think you saved his life.
Pat says he does start his very first blog or letter to his readers out by talking about that he really began to look at connecting with his readers, taking that more seriously and so forth after a real health scare. And he was first to admit that he did not take care of himself at all and had not for years and years. And it was beginning to catch up with him, you know. He ate too much, he drank too much, he did not take care of himself in any way.
He didn't exercise.
He did not exercise at all, and he was not interested. You couldn't get him to do, you know. He was stubborn as all get out as well, and, you know, you couldn't even trick him into doing these kind of things. So a good health scare made a difference a few years ago. And so he starts to examine his life at that point in a different way. And also, I think being the age then in his, at that time, you know, later 60s, really makes you begin to think, well, you know, I'm not going to be around forever. I might want to, you know, try to prolong this and take better care of myself.
Well, and part of that was besides your TLC and his having almost a road to Emmaus moment of discovering what he needed to do, is there were still books he wanted to write, and that was a driving force, too.
Yes, yes. He I talked about in my introduction that Pat was the bravest person I've ever known. He was always almost Don Quixote-like, with, you know, charging after. But his weren't windmills. They were real issues and so forth. If he felt passionate about something and he felt like there was an injustice, he wouldn't hesitate. I might feel these things, but, you know, sometimes I'd be kind of hesitant to, well, you know, just kind of let that go and see what happens. But not bad. He was so brave. He had so much courage. But his fear was that he would run out of time before he got to write all the books, which unfortunately is what happened.
And he was working on what he thought was going to be his last book or second to last book.
Second to last book that he knew of. He had been saying for a long time he was going to write an Atlanta novel. So based on his contract with Nantelis, he had contract for two more novels, and she was very interested in the Atlanta novel, as I was, as, you know, a lot of folks, because, I mean, we have The Man in Full, or is it A Man in Full? I can't remember. Tom Wolfe's, but I'm not sure there's really been a great big Pat Conroy-like Atlanta novel. Maybe A Man in Full is the closest to it. And so I was really interested to see what Pat would do with that topic. But I also had encouraged him to write one day about, a lot of folks don't know that Pat taught school for 2 years in high school at Buford High School before he went to DeFusky. Because DeFusky and, you know, the movie and the book and everything got so much attention. There's not been much said about his 2 years teaching right out of college. And he had these three young male teachers. They all, this was their first year teaching. They were all draft dodgers teaching because it was during the Vietnam War years. And none of them knew what they were doing and all this kind of stuff. And then they all went to Europe together that summer, and they had all sorts of adventures. So every time he would tell me about this, I would say, you know, you really need to write about that one day. I was thinking maybe more nonfiction kind of thing, because I don't know that I've ever read a book about that kind of bonding between male teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought that would be a unique kind of book. Well, he started, I didn't even know he'd started writing it when he started writing, told me he was working on another novel. I thought it was the Atlanta novel, and Nantelis did too, because that's what he was supposed to be writing.
So that was the book he was working on?
That was the book he was working on.
When he died. And so the unfinished manuscript, what's going to be the story there?
I absolutely do not know, Walter. He has written about 200 pages of it. Now, for most writers, like myself and normal writers, you know, it'd be a good, you know, halfway through the book. With Pat, he was just getting started. He had these guys, he had set them up, and he had these four young men who he, in his fictionalized version of it, they had all graduated from the Citadel and were looking for teaching jobs. One of them had just gotten married. So that's what his setup was. And he had just gotten the Pat character in the book, he called him Mike. Mike had just gotten a teaching job at Buford, and that's in the first 200 pages. That's as far as he had gotten. He hadn't got him in the classroom yet.
Well, this has happened before with unfinished manuscripts. Do you let it lie? Do you have somebody, do you finish it? Does Nantelis finish? I mean, are that...
I certainly hope something will be done with it. Frankly, I don't see anyone finishing it. I think that Pat had such a unique writing style. I just, I can't see anyone else. I don't know anyone else who writes like Pat.
There's so many facets to Pat Conroy. And we talk about Tell Me a Story. People keep coming out with stories. His dealing with fans is legendary. I mean, they're in this book. They've been said publicly. But not too long ago, just 2 years ago, he was in Columbia, and we had a conversation. He and I had a conversation at the Township Auditorium in Columbia, just like you and I are having one now. And we finished about 9 o'clock, and Pat stayed till after 1 o'clock for the people who were lined up who wanted to him to sign their books. Now, knowing Pat, he couldn't just sign the book. He wanted to know something about everybody who was in line, and he could make connections. I think that is one of the reasons that people have responded so to the center, is he touched people, and, you know, he's signing the book, and as sometimes people would do, bring 4 or 5 books under their arm, and I want this to Uncle Joe, and I want this, you know. He never stopped. He just did it. And I can tell you of folks who would say, well, I've been here 30 minutes. It's time for me to leave. I've done my job. Pat's job, as he saw it, these people care about my book. I'm going to care about them. That's something you can't teach. And you wonder, did this come from Gene Norris? Did it come from Doc?
Yeah.
Don't think it came from the great Santini.
Imagine not. Yeah. I wrote about that in my introduction. That was one of the main things I wanted to focus on in the introduction, is Pat's connection with his readers, because I've never seen anything like it. His book signings were just events in themselves, just the book signings. They would go on for hours. He would talk to everybody about what he was talking to and what he wanted. He believed that everybody had at least one story to tell. And Pat would get those stories out of you if they could be gotten out.
Well, that's what good writers do. They file those stories away. And he made no bones about he milked Alex Sanders for all he was worth. People listened and related, and then Pat put to paper. But a lot of those, they came from somewhere in here with Pat.
He was all about story, and I think that's one of the things that made him one of the great writers of our time, is that he not only wrote so beautifully, but he always had a story behind it as well. And that's the difference to me. I mean, A Tale of Two Cities, what do you remember about that? That's a beautiful story, you know. It's the story that makes the human connection. And that's what Pat looked for, and that's what all of his books had. All of them had that human connection. So he didn't just have just this amazingly beautiful writing and imagery and so forth, but also these wonderful, wonderful, unforgettable stories.
Well, you're quite a storyteller yourself.
Well, I tell a lot of stories, if that's what you mean, Walter.
Well, from being the preacher's wife to Same Sweet Girls to Moonrise. And that's another Pat story I want to talk about. Y'all have been married for a few years, because this would have been Walter Edgar's Journal we started in 2001. We've been doing it now for almost 16 years.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I went in to interview you, and one of the things I asked was, what's it like with two writers? I mean, I've known friends who are both historians in a family, and that doesn't always work out when people are writing. And I think Pat said, well, we get up, and Sandra goes and she writes, and I go and I write. We're not passing our stuff back and forth for critiquing. We're writing. He basked in the success of your books. It wasn't, oh gosh, it's been a few years since I've got one out and she's gotten two out. which was the case.
he was so supportive. He was supportive of every writer that he met. As far as I know, I don't know of a case where he really tried to discourage anyone from writing. Though he would say that, you know, you got to realize what you're getting yourself into if you really want to do this. It's a lot of hard work and it's not glamorous and all this sort of stuff. But he was certainly very, very encouraging of me and my writing.
Well, your prose is much sparer than Pat's.
Everybody's prose is sparer than Pat's.
So I guess he never got Thomas Wolfe out of his system.
You know, it's really interesting. One of the things he would ask me to do occasionally was to help with editing. He would know that he would have to cut something back because he would have a chapter that was 50 something pages long, you know, and so much of it was descriptive and so forth. And Nan, his publisher and editor, would send it back to him to trim some of the fat off of it, maybe. And so he would ask me to go over. He'd just hand it over and say, just cut anything out of it that you could. It was one of the hardest things I ever had to do. As a matter of fact, because Pat always said he would never use one adjective when he could use 20 instead. And that was absolutely true. But what I would, you know, what I'm doing that was just a great way to study his writing and the way he wrote and so forth, because that's what he would just pile on. I guess it's almost like putting whipped cream on a sundae or something like that. He would just keep piling on these beautiful, gorgeous images and similes and, you know, metaphors and stuff like that, so that sometimes I would have to think, okay, some of these have got to go, you know. But they're all so beautiful, I wouldn't even know which ones to cut. And sometimes it was almost just like close my eyes and mark some of them off.
Well, now, this may be apocryphal, this may be urban legend or writer's legend, but the word is, as big as Beach Music is in publication, that it was almost twice that size when it went to the...
I understand it was over 1,000 handwritten pages.
For Beach Music?
Yeah, for Beach Music. And they really, really had to cut back on that. But what I would like now is to see what they cut out.
I've mentioned this Alabama connection that keeps coming into Pat Conroy's life, not just for you. One of his favorite places to go was in Fairhope, Alabama, to Page and Palette Bookshop. There are a lot of similarities between our part of Alabama and the Lowcountry. When I read Same Sweet Girls, I didn't identify all of the folks, but I knew exactly where you were. Mm-hmm. I've been on that dock in the bay. Mm-hmm. And when you're on the Gulf Coast and you have a southern night, it's totally different from looking out to the Atlantic. I mean, you are looking at the Southern Cross and you're looking out the Gulf and the sugar sand, white sand beaches. Like I said, I knew you captured that as beautifully as he has captured the soul of the Lowcountry. And the folks in Alabama appreciate that.
Thank you for that. I love that part of the country, and that's where, you know, I was raised, because of, I mean, I've been asked before, will you ever write about the Lowcountry? And usually my answer was, well, no, I think I live with the person who's captured that the best, you know, that it can be done. But
well, yeah. We had talked about teachers earlier, and I made a mark in this book. This is Pat at a meeting with teachers. He's giving a presentation. He says, why do we hate our teachers in this country? I asked them, and not one of them disagrees with me, from Santa Fe to Charleston, from New Orleans to Philadelphia. I don't know why, but I agree with you, the teachers say in almost a unanimous voice. The teachers of my life saved my life and sent me out prepared for whatever life I was meant to lead. Like everyone else, I had some bad ones and mediocre ones, but I never had one that I thought was holding me back because of idleness or thoughtlessness. They spent their lives with the likes of me, and I felt safe during the time they spent with me. Teaching is an art form, pure and simple. I'll trust a teacher over a bureaucrat every single time, a teacher over an administrator. And he didn't say it, but parentheses, Doc, this does not apply to you. And of course, Doc is another Newberry connection with Pat. And I'm not sure if the folks realize here is that one of the very first public appearances Pat made for The Water Is Wide was to a book club here in Newberry.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
No.
See, I just took the historian to find out.
That's right.
Like that.
That's good thing about being, you know, historian.
Is there any passage from this book that you might like to read?
Can't think of anything offhand.
Okay.
Walter, I've read some, you know, parts of it to audiences before, but if you have something marked, go ahead.
I can understand why this might still be a little rich for you.
Yeah.
But this is after he's written The Prince of Tides. His mother's dying. Mm-hmm. She's in the hospital. One moon-filled night, I stayed in my mother's room to help her through the terrible hours, and she wanted to talk about The Prince of Tides. "I'm in your new book, aren't I, Pat?" she asked. "No," I said. "Liar," she said. "When you wrote The Great Santini, you weren't good enough to write about me. I was far more powerful than your father ever was. You just didn't see it." "I saw it, Mama," I said. "But you're right. I wasn't good enough to write about it. I'd like to ask you a favor in the new book, Pat. Don't write about me like this. Make me beautiful. Make me beautiful again." I knelt beside my mother's bed and said in a voice that I barely recognized, "I'll make you so beautiful, Mama. You made me a writer, and I'm going to lift you out of this bed and set you singing and dancing across the pages of my book forever. And after you write about my death," my mother said with a smile, "I'd like Meryl Streep to play the role in the movie." My mother was like a whole civilization of women wrapped up in a single comely package. She was complicated, maddening, irreplaceable. I will never be good enough to write about her. In part, The Prince of Tide is a love letter to the dark side of my mother. I don't think you'd like the portrait, Mama, but wherever you are, I made you beautiful. And that's, to me, a love song from a son to his father.
Yes.
And, you know, speaking of admiration and, in a way, a love song of appreciation, there was a letter found in the Newberry College archives written by Pat to Doc. And I think we might ask his brother Tim to join us on stage to read that letter.
I think that would be lovely.
Tim Conroy.
Really, the setup for this letter has been talked about, but I'll just remind everybody. Pat graduated from the Citadel in 1967. A lot of his friends went to the Vietnam War, and a lot of his friends did not come back. So in the summer of 1968, his great friends took the trip to Europe. And while Pat was in Europe, he took time to write a letter to Dr. Dufford. And so, in my view, this letter is completely without cynicism. Very few people have read this letter. And the original copy of this letter is over at the Spears Street School, the new College of Education building, in the Dufford Diversity Room. in Pat's original script. So, without further ado, I'll read the letter. Dear Doc, the kid you once shoved around the St. Paul locker room for 10 minutes has managed to live down his nefarious past or meager beginnings. He is now cruising on the Aegean Sea, having just left Crete, en route to Beirut, Lebanon. I've been doing a lot of thinking on this cruise, and it seems whenever I think you loom as an important figure, presiding over and in some unfathomable way, guiding and directing whatever decision I make. So it has been for 5 years, so it is now. For 3 years now, I have wondered about my position in the great scheme of things. This year, it became almost agony. The thought of gradual deterioration, of age, of death, of everything significant to man during his tenure on Earth. I have met 3 interesting people on the journey. They are intelligent, older, and they are still asking the same questions I am asking myself. I don't know if I ever will be content with what I am doing, but I wonder now if anything but the human oxen of the world ever are. Everything I have done since leaving Beaufort has been a reflection of the summer I spent with you digging those damn ditches and painting those damn bookcases. I have never understood the dynamics of hero worship. Maybe it was the discovery of the father I never had as a youth and finally found in you. A father that was not only stern, but was tender. A father of both the storm and the sun. All these things come before me now, Doc. All these things in a mixture of joy and sorrow. The realization of days lost, memories vanished, delicious moments carried and discarded by divergent winds. It is important for you to know this effect you've had, and I believe you know it, but in the shortness and horrible brevity of life, I want to get everything said. Everything. Someday I will exert the same influence over someone, and I want to tell, and I want him to tell me, this is immortality. For what I have learned from you, I will pass on. And I will pass on, and I will pass on. I was in New York before I left for Europe, and I walked over to the Hotel Chesterfield from Radio City Music Hall. Nothing had changed much, except the years and the memories. This time I smiled. Pat. So, one of the things I think about, you know, this letter is just how much Beaufort changed Pat. When he came to Beaufort at 16, really at 15, and spent those 2 years, he met students, he met teachers, he met the staff that accepted him with love and encouragement, and made the difference in his life. And so that's what we want to do at the Literary Center, at the Pat Conroy Literary Center, because storytelling was an act of love for Pat. And so we want to encourage writers from 8 to 80 to find their voice, to give them the resources they need to dig deep into their authenticity so they can tell their stories. The truth is, my brother Pat will never write another letter, never write another book. But if we can help others do that and have his generosity of heart carry on to them, then we take what Beaufort gave Pat, what Dr. Dufford gave Pat. We take that love, that encouragement, that acceptance, and that goes on and on and on. And to me, that is literary immortality. And that's what we hope to do at the Pat Conroy Literary Center. Now, one of the things I wanted just to say is, you know, the Conroy family isn't the only family that has suffered loss. Many of you have suffered great loss of dear loved ones. We would like to be there for you as much as you have been there for us this year. So on behalf of Sandra and the Conroy family, I just want to thank you for your encouragement and love. And thank you for letting me speak.
Sandra, would you like to add anything at this point?
Yeah, I would. I would like to just say the same thing that Tim has said, the outpouring of love that we have felt since we all lost Pat has really sustained me. I'm sure it has you as well. I have been on book tour for Pat's book. It came out, his publicist asked if I would go out and speak and said, this may be something that you're not able to do. And I didn't know if I could. But the main way that I was able to do so is because I knew that Pat would have done it for me. So I thought I owed that to him. And it has been an amazing experience. Everywhere I've gone, when I've talked about Pat, when I've read some of my introduction or something like this and kind of glanced up, I would see people crying. And, oh, it was, you know, it was so moving. And folks would come up to me afterwards, or sometimes if we had a question and answer, they would just stand up and tell everyone, oh, I met Pat. It was just exactly as you said. I met him at a book signing. You know, he became my best friend practically in those few moments that I, and then talk about how his writing had influenced their lives and how he told the stories that they related to, that they had always been afraid to tell about their own families, and it always also helped them to see that they weren't alone in their struggles as well. And so I want to join Tim in thanking all of you.
Well, Sandra, I'd like to close off with not just how I feel, but I think all South Carolinians feel. I'll do something that literary critics do all the time, regardless of whether they come from the Robert Penn Warren School of traditional critics or from today's deconstructionists, and I know what Pat thought about deconstructionists. Literary critics like to put words into the mouths of authors, as in he, she really meant to say this or that. Well, I'm going to take a quote from South Abroad, and I'm going to turn it a little bit. And it is the protagonist, but it goes like this. It is the Carolina Lowcountry, and it is mine. I am lucky enough, man, that I can sing hymns of praise to it for the rest of my life. And so Pat Conroy did. God bless him, and we are the lucky ones because he did so. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, a good night.
Good night.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know I did. It was a very special occasion in Newbury with Cassandra King, not just to be with her, because she is an old and dear friend, but also to talk about Pat Conroy, the man and the author. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.